Let's now go to the final chapter in this unit, meaning the final chapter before Thursday's examination. And hopefully I can get through this. I think I have time. But if I don't, like if I have a slide or two left, remember you still have the recordings to go by. So you'll still have lectures to study. I think I can finish it though. In this first slide, we're looking at the scientific apparatus, a cartoon version of the apparatus that was set up in a famous experiment called the Miller-Urey experiment. You don't have to remember who the scientists were, but this was done originally back in the 50s to try to determine whether it was possible to make the building blocks of life without life. Now, this brings up the notion of, well, no, I'll get to that later. I want to make sure I have time for this. We'll talk about that in a different chapter. But I've already told you that any given cell, all cells, are made of, in addition to small run-of-the-mill molecules, like water molecules and things like that, four categories of macromolecules, right? Lipids, polysaccharides, nucleic acids, and what's the one I forgot there? Proteins, yes, the truly important ones. They're all really important for their own reasons. The point here is that you can't. It's impossible to even imagine life without all four of these. So this gets back to the notion of cell theory. Remember, cell theory tells us that cells come from pre-existing cells, at least nowadays, and it's been that way for billions of years. But obviously it can't have always been that way, right? There had to be some original cells that didn't come from pre-existing cells that formed in early Earth's oceans and became the first successful cells, and that was the ancestor to all life now. That's the trunk of the overall tree of life, those first originally successful cells. But if you think about how that can happen, a cell that is going to not come from pre-existing cells has to at least come from materials, subcellular molecules, in other words, that cells require to be alive. Namely, those four kinds of macromolecules. And those macromolecules, those four categories, are not only macromolecules, which simply means that they're big. They are specifically organic macromolecules, carbon-containing macromolecules, that didn't necessarily exist in early Earth's conditions. Now, there's almost a billion years, 800 million years or so of early Earth history before there was any life at all. And that's an inconceivably long time from our point of view. So there was a lot of changes that occurred even before there were the first cells in place. And it was a drastically different, inhospitable place. It was called the Hadean Aeon because it was hellish. It was very hot. Unlivable conditions for modern organisms. But the point here is how does the Earth get to the situation in which it has the building blocks, these molecules themselves that organisms are made out of, before there are any organisms? And this experiment demonstrated that conditions on early Earth were enough. Now, that's not to say that that's the only way you could get these. They could also be brought in from comets and other things from space. The building block, the molecules necessary. But even if it was just left to the Earth conditions, this demonstrates you have enough simple building blocks to make these larger building blocks, which can then become biological macromolecules. So you have this heated up ocean because it was very hot, with very simple materials that we are pretty certain were in the ocean at the time. Simple things like methane, for instance, and an atmosphere in this other bulb that is fitted with electrodes. So you can spark it every once in a while to mimic lightning. And remember, you have 800 million years to wait in this experiment, in the real experiment. But it only takes weeks to do this. And if you just do this for weeks and take samples, you can start seeing amino acids, which didn't exist before, but are the building blocks for proteins and so on. So this indicates that, molecularly speaking, if you give it enough time and the correct conditions, you will get biological molecules even before there's really biology, even before they're used in a way in a cell that has life. You'll learn more about that in 182 as well, but that's what that experiment is. The rest of this chapter has to do with molecules that contain carbon. And so I said earlier, just a minute ago, that we use the word organic in chemistry to denote carbon-containing, but that's not enough of a definition for organic. First, let me say that historically, for until not all that long ago, really, in human history, we thought that there was a fundamental difference between the stuff that living things are made out of and the stuff that non-living things are made out of. And we thought that it was impossible to make the stuff that living things are made out of unless you use living or dead sources. If you use non-living sources, we thought it was impossible to make things that you find in organisms. And that's why we use the word organic, meaning from an organism. Okay? Well, now it's routine. It's easy to synthesize artificially organic material, stuff that you find in organisms. But that's the essence of the name. So organic means various things. It ranges from meaningless to somewhat meaningful in grocery stores as a word. Those are totally different uses of the word. In chemistry, organic means not only carbon containing, but hydrogen containing as well. And often there are other things like oxygen and nitrogen. The reason you have to specify that is because there are things that contain carbon that are not considered organic, including pure carbon. So, first of all, to be organic, it has to be a compound, not the element carbon. For instance, you're writing with a pencil probably. We call that lead. It has nothing to do with the element lead anymore. It's graphite, which is one example of pure carbon. That's not organic, even though there's nothing in there but carbon. Diamond is another form of pure carbon, more expensive than graphite, but it's still pure carbon, nothing but carbon atoms. That's also not organic. And neither is carbon dioxide, even though it's a compound, carbon and oxygen. But the vast majority of carbon-containing compounds are classified as organic, including all of the ones that we see in this second slide. You can see glancing at the ball and stick models that they are compounds, right? There's two different kinds of atoms involved. The black ones are carbons and the white ones are hydrogens, just like in the molecular modeling lab. More specifically, these are not only organic compounds. All of these examples happen to be hydrocarbons. Hydrocarbons get their name because there's nothing in those molecules except hydrogen and carbon. And don't confuse the word hydrocarbon with carbohydrate. Carbohydrates contain carbon and hydrogen also, but they include oxygen as well. No hydrocarbon has oxygen in it, only carbon and hydrogen. And so these are three examples of hydrocarbons. Methane is the simplest possible one because it has just one carbon. And remember, carbon has tetravalence. or maybe I shouldn't say remember because I don't know whether I told you that word before or not, but tetravalent simply means having a valence of four, because tetra means four, like in tetrahedron. So carbon is a tetravalent element. Now, if you look at the periodic table, you should understand why it's tetravalent. It's four steps from the right edge, right? Tetravalent means that it needs four more electrons to fill its valence subshell. It's not the only tetravalent element. But look at the periodic table and tell me what's special about carbon among the tetravalent elements. What are the other tetravalent elements? Silicon, germanium, and so on. In other words, all the ones in the same group or column as carbon, right? But don't overthink this. What is special about carbon in that column, in that group? It's the smallest. It's at the top, right? Yes. Carbon is the smallest tetravalent element. And that's why it's the basis of life. It's why we are carbon-based life, we say often. The reason that the tetravalence is a big deal is because having to make four bonds to satisfy your valence, which is what a tetravalent atom does, means you are more versatile than all the other nonmetals that can make molecules like nitrogen and oxygen with respect to how those bonds are made. Right? If you have to make four total, well, let's consider hydrogen as a nonmetal. Not very variable, right? It has to make one bond. So every hydrogen in any molecule is making a single covalent bond. But in carbon, it's making four overall bonds. Well, there's a lot of ways you can do that. You can make four single bonds. You can make two double bonds. You can make a single bond and a triple bond, all of which add up to four, right? That alone gives you a lot of variety compared to the others. If you're making four single bonds, it can be four of the same thing, like in methane, all of them are hydrogen. You can have one of those bonds be with one and three of the other single bonds with another one, or you can have four different ones, right? If you have two double bonds, it can be with the same things or different ones and so on. So there's the greatest variety of mixing elements with carbon to form molecules if you have tetravalence. And carbon is the simplest tetravalent atom, therefore it has great diversity. That's why in chemistry, which is an immense science overall, you break it down into two also immense sub-disciplines within chemistry, which are organic chemistry and inorganic chemistry. Everything that deals with carbon compounds and everything else. It's that important. So, hydrocarbons are, of course, organic because they are carbon-containing compounds. There are plenty of other organic compounds, though, that are not hydrocarbons. While we're still on hydrocarbons, though, let me say that these make excellent fuels. Hydrocarbons, in general, make excellent fuels. And, you know, if you think about an internal combustion engine, which, sadly, most of us still use, powered by gasoline, which is a mixture. Gasoline is just a mixture of different hydrocarbons. Individually, there's all kinds of different hydrocarbons mixed into gasoline, but they make hydrocarbons in general make excellent fuels because carbon and hydrogen have roughly the same electronegativity, and so those electrons are being shared roughly equally. We'll get into why that makes good fuels in a different chapter, but that's why. Related with that, though, since carbon and hydrogen have roughly the same electronegativities, what kind of bonds are these between carbon and hydrogen? Nonpolar, exactly. Hydrocarbons are nonpolar, which means they don't mix well in water, right? Okay, well, we're going to survey all four of the macromolecular types in its own chapter. But in slide three, we have here this familiar depiction of shells as being circles around a nucleus with dots in them representing electrons. And this just explains tetravalence that I've already described in words, but now you can see in pictures that compared to the other nonmetals, the other three big nonmetals that are in organisms in general, because remember, any given organism in terms of atoms is mostly oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, and hydrogen. But compared to carbon, these other three aren't as versatile because they can't make bonds in nearly as great a number of ways, especially hydrogen. The only variability for hydrogen is that it can bond to different kinds of atoms, but it always makes just one bond because its valence is one. Four is a structural formula for urea, which is an organic compound. And the only reason really that this is in this slideshow is that this has I'll say two things about it. One is that to be organic, you don't necessarily have to have carbon-hydrogen bonds. Notice that this one doesn't have carbon-hydrogen bonds. There's hydrogen in it, but not connected directly to the carbon. Anyway, it's the main importance of urea in terms of the history of all this is that urea was the first successfully synthesized organic compound. That's when we proved that it is possible to make stuff that you find in organisms without using other organisms. You just make it out of non-living stuff, inorganic material. And that was the first to be successfully synthesized. Now we can do it pretty routinely. So there is no fundamental difference chemically between non-living things and living things. Okay, now to five. Just like two slides ago, all of the examples shown in this slide are not only organic, but specifically hydrocarbons. You see that these are all hydrocarbons, right? There's nothing but carbons and hydrogens here. And what you see in A, B, C, and D is that there are these four and other ways as well, but four major ways in which you can classify hydrocarbons. And they're fundamentally different ways of classifying them. Each way of classifying them really has nothing to do with the other types. That's what I mean by fundamentally different. So you can classify hydrocarbons based on what is called the chain length. The chain is simply all of the carbons, however many there are in the molecule. So ethane has a chain length of two carbons. That's why the chain, or more correctly speaking, the carbon skeleton, because it's not necessarily just a linear chain, it can be branched as well. However many carbons there are, though, that's called the carbon skeleton. It's not the entire molecule, right? But if we're talking about a hydrocarbon, then the only other thing besides the carbon skeleton have to be hydrogens, because you can't allow any other kind of thing in a hydrocarbon by definition. So ethane and propane are two hydrocarbons, and they differ in the length of their carbon skeletons. So that's length is one way that we can specify them. And notice that the ethane and propane both end in A-N-E. They are both examples of what are called alkanes. Alkane is not a specific chemical. It's a category of hydrocarbons. But notice the alkane word ends in A-N-E. An alkane is a hydrocarbon that contains only single bonds. No double bonds, no triple bonds in alkanes. And the eth part means two. Meth means one, which is why the simplest alkane is methane. It ends in A-N-E to tell you it's an alkane, so only single bonds. Meth means one, eth means two, prop means three, bute means four, so butane has four carbons and so on. Octane, which is part of gasoline, has eight carbons. Okay, so length is one way. Double bonds, to the right of that, the presence or absence of double bonds is another way of distinguishing hydrocarbons. So alkanes don't have double bonds, right? But if you have a hydrocarbon that has at least one double bond, then it's not an alkane, but an alkene, E-N-E. And therefore, the individual chemicals that are alkenes get names that end in E-N-E to tell you that. Well, here you have, remember I said bute is four? These are four carbon compounds, so bute means four carbons. But it's not butane, it's butene, because it has at least one double bond. Well, these two are very, very similar. There are two different versions of butene because there's two possible positions for the double bond. It can be right in the middle of the four-carbon skeleton, or it can be one to either side, and it doesn't matter which side. It's the same thing. So this brings up another definition. One butene and two butene are examples of isomers. What does iso mean? Same, yes. Isomers are different versions of the same. Well, they're different chemicals, but they have identical chemical formulae. Right? So, notice that there's eight hydrogens in each of these. Both one butene and two butene have the chemical formula C4H8, which is why you can't tell from the symbols which one you're talking about. They have exactly the same chemical formula, but they're distinct chemicals because it's arranged differently. We call those things isomers. And hydrocarbons have a lot of isomers. But anyway, we can distinguish them or categorize them based on double bonds. Another is whether or not the carbon skeletons branches. So we have butane here, four carbons, that's the butane. Ane means alkane, so there's only single bonds. But there's butane and another one that uses four carbons and only single bonds, 2-methylpropane. The only difference is whether it's a carbons all in one line or if there's a branch. Well, when you only have four carbons in your skeleton, those are the only two possible ways you can either branch or not branch. The more carbons you add one at a time, the more and more possible branching or non-branching there is. So there's all kinds of different isomers when you start having a lot of carbons in the skeleton. And then finally, you can distinguish them based on whether or not the carbon skeleton forms rings. None of these other examples were ring-like, but cyclohexane and benzene, the carbon skeleton comes back and bonds to itself to form a ring structure. And these are often things that we can easily sense olfactorily. They have a lot of smell, which is why we call them the aromatic compounds, things you find in cologne and stuff like that. All right, to six. In six, we're looking at one molecule, and this is an example of a macromolecule. Specifically, it is a lipid as opposed to a nucleic acid or a protein or a polysaccharide. This is a lipid. But even more specifically than that, this is a fat. And so one thing I want to say about fats is that the word fat and the word lipid are not interchangeable. Sometimes people use them to mean the same thing. They don't. Fats are just one category of lipids. In other words, all fats are lipids, but not all lipids are fats. Okay? But this is a fat. This is a single fat molecule, which can also be called a triglyceride. Actually, it goes by other names as well, but this is enough for now because we're going to revisit fats in a different chapter. For now, though, just let me... What's important in this chapter is that a fat features three of these tails highlighted in yellow. That's why the tri in the word triglyceride. There's three of these tails. Well, if you have just a tail by itself, it's not a fat. You have to have this whole arrangement. But just mentally picture one of these tails just by itself. What do you have there? What kind of molecule would that be if it were just by itself? Based on what atoms you have here. Nothing but black and white. Right? Therefore, what kind of molecule would it be? Black is carbon, white is hydrogen. Hydrocarbons. Right. Now, this fat overall is not a hydrocarbon because it has these oxygens as well, right? But the tail, or at least almost all of the tail except the very end of it, and the tail, by the way, is called a fatty acid, which is just part of a fat. A fatty acid, if it weren't for this very end, would be a hydrocarbon. It's almost a hydrocarbon. And I just told you that hydrocarbons are good fuels, right? That's why your car runs on them. Well, this is why the body runs well on fats. Fats have a lot of energy in them. And this is why when we take in more energy in the form of food than we actually need based on what we're using for metabolism and exercise, we don't waste that. Because throughout human history, we haven't had enough food. So we've evolved mechanisms to save that energy for later. But regardless of whether it comes in as whatever kind of nutrient, we save it in the form of fat. We convert it into fat to store it. Because compared to proteins or polysaccharides, fats contain a much greater amount of energy per gram. They have, in other words, they have a higher energy density than other kinds of molecules. If we stored our extra energy as proteins or as polysaccharides in our body, it would take more of those molecules to store that same amount of energy. So we would weigh more than we do if we stored them as fat. And that would make us harder to move around without actually having more stored energy. So fats are important for that reason, but they are important lipids as far as molecules are concerned, and we'll talk more about them in a different chapter. Just let me say, though, that since these tails are mostly hydrocarbon, meaning they're only carbons and hydrogens for most of the length, what else is true about them? I said that hydrocarbons make good fuels, which fats are in the body. What else did I say about hydrocarbons? It was related to the fact that they make good fuels. Right, right. Each carbon-hydrogen bond is a sharing of a pair of electrons between two atoms that have about the same electronegativity. They're fairly low compared to oxygen, for instance, or nitrogen, that are greedy, right? Carbon and hydrogen aren't as greedy, so they equally share those electrons. And therefore, that makes each carbon-hydrogen bond what? Nonpolar. And therefore, they do not mix well in polar solvents like water. Oil is hydrocarbon. Fats, like oil, do not mix in water, right? If you put the two together, you're going to see the oil rise above because it's not as dense as the water. It doesn't weigh as much, but it is nutrient dense. It has a lot of energy in it. It just doesn't have much stuff, much matter. So it comes to the top, but it doesn't mix with water because polar things like to be around other polar things. Nonpolar things like to be around other nonpolar things, but polar things and nonpolar things don't like to be around each other. And that is truly important to the history of biology as well. That we wouldn't have cells if it weren't for that fact. Okay, now let's go to 7 and talk more about isomers. I already introduced this term earlier. Any given pair of isomers are isomers of each other, in other words, if and only if they have exactly the same chemical formula, which is another way of saying they have exactly the same kinds of atoms and the same number of each kind of atom in their structure. But they're different chemically. They are distinct compounds, not the same chemical as each other, because of the way those same atoms and number of atoms are arranged in the two isomers. So recognize all of these three boxes as a pair of isomers. In the right and left of each box, it's exactly the same number of carbons, hydrogens, or whatever else is involved. They have the same structural formulae, right and left. But there's three major categories. Once again, actually more than three, but in this course, we're paying attention to three different categories of isomers. We define isomers in different ways. One is as structural isomers, which is simply an arrangement of the carbon skeleton. This is an example we've already looked at, right? Pentane versus 2-methylbutane. Both of them have exactly 5 carbons in them, but actually, this is not the one we looked at before. It was butane. This is pentane. But they're exactly the same. They have 5 carbons in each, same number of hydrogens as each other as well. But one of them has a linear carbon skeleton. The other one has a branched. So they are structural isomers. Geometric isomers below that is a little different thing going on here. On the top, on the first one, structural isomers, notice that those are both alkanes, right? Because they have only single bonds. That's why their names end in A-N-E. Geometric isomers don't make sense if you're talking about alkanes. For geometric isomers to exist, you have to be talking about alkenes. Or maybe even alkynes with Y-N-E. That's a triple bond involved. The reason is that you guys made ball and stick models last time, right? Think about your single bonds, which were the wooden pegs. Any given single bond, wooden peg, it's possible to swivel it, right? So one half of the molecule you could put in any position because you could swivel a single bond. But a pair of springs, which represents a double bond, you can't do that with. You can start to swivel it, but it's not going to go all the way around, right? Well, if you have a double bond between carbons in two different molecules, in a molecule, then it kind of locks the rest of the molecule into one position since you can't swivel that double bond. And therefore, depending on which position it's locked into, there are two possibilities here. The cis configuration and the trans configuration. Cis means same side, trans means across or other side. Same prefixes, for instance, that we use nowadays for genders. Cisgender and transgender. So a cis isomer is the one that has these X's, which can represent anything other than hydrogen, on the same side of the double bond. But you could have the same exact thing on opposite sides of the double bond. That would be the trans version of the isomer. Very subtle difference, but they behave differently chemically depending on which isomer you have. So they are distinct chemicals. And then the bottom one is a different category of isomers called enantiomers. And enantiomers are examples not only of isomers, but they're examples of compounds that we say are chiral, or they have chirality. C-H-I-R-A-L. Chiral means what?
Well, where else do you see chiro as a prefix?
Chiropractor, for instance, which is someone who uses his or her hands on you. This is why I got the name. Chiro means hand. And chiral, the adjective, means handed, having handedness, meaning that there's a left-handed version and a right-handed version. Just like gloves and hands themselves are chiral. Right? Well, not surgical gloves, but normal thick gloves. You can tell if you put the left glove on your right hand that it doesn't fit well, right? It's not the, there's a difference in gloves. And your hands themselves, which is why hands are shown here, you know, they seem very, very similar to each other, but they are actually mirror images of each other. They're not the same. So if you were to cut your hand off without hurting yourself somehow, there's no way that you could flop your right hand around or rearrange it in space to make it look just like your left hand. Because they are mirror images, they are different from each other. Similarly, if you have a carbon atom, which is tetravalent, remember, and it's forming four bonds with four different things at the corners of the tetrahedron, and it doesn't matter what they are, if they're different from each other, in this case it's oxygen and a methyl group, a hydrogen and an NH2, but it doesn't matter. As long as those four corners are different, if you imagine making that as a ball and stick model, there's no way that you can pick that up and just rotate it in space and make it look like the other version. The only way to do that would be to break two of the bonds and swap them out to make the mirror image. So that means enantiomers have handedness. What look like identical molecules are actually mirror images of each other. So for each of that chemical formula, there's a right-handed version and a left-handed version. And that matters as to what other things that they will interact with. We can see that in slide 8. Here you have two drugs, ibuprofen, albuterol. The examples don't matter, but it's two drugs. And remember I said that drugs are examples of exogenous signals? Signals don't have any effect unless they bind to a receptor, right? So in these examples of drugs, they're chiral, so there's a right-handed and a left-handed version. But if you use the wrong-handed version, meaning not the correct version to fit into the receptor that you have in your body, then they won't work. It would be like putting your right hand into a left glove. It's not going to fit. And therefore your body will just ignore it. And all the money made to develop the drug would be wasted. You have to have a match between the drug and, or the signal in general, whether it's a drug or an endogenous signal, you have to have a match between that and the receptor. Okay? So there's an effective version and an ineffective version, but it's not always that right is ineffective and left is effective or vice versa. It just depends on a case-by-case basis. In this case, ibuprofen has the S version, the effective one. That's the left-handed version. S, by the way, stands for sinistro. Which is a prefix. It corresponds to the word sinister. There's a lot of ways that the majority right-handers of the world have basically made life miserable for the left-handers of the world. One is by calling them sinister, which literally means left-handed. We say, man, that person is suspicious, sinister. Suspicious, acting like he's a left-hander, which is ridiculous. And dextro is a prefix that means right-handed. We also have the word dexterous, right? Which means using your hands well. That means literally right-handed, like left-handed people can't use their hands well. And if you add ambi in front, which means dual or both, ambidextrous doesn't mean you can use your hands, doesn't literally mean you can use both hands equally well. It literally means having both right hands, which is another way that we don't like the left-handers of the world. But anyway, S and R stand for sinistro and recto, which is another word that means right. And the right-handed version for ibuprofen is not effective because the receptor in the body is left-handed. On the other hand, albuterol uses the right-handed version. R, albuterol, is effective. S, the left-hand version, is ineffective, once again, because the receptor happens to be, in that case, right-handed. So that matters. Chirality matters. Slide 9 is another example, but L-DOPA and D-DOPA use different, they don't use the S and the R, which means sinistro and recto, left and right respectively. They use L and D. L means levo, which means left. D means dextro, which means right. And why there are multiple standards, why they don't use S and R all the time, is actually dependent. It doesn't matter to this course. Just realize that L corresponds to left, just like S does. D and R both correspond to right. But if you can see this, if you look at drug labels, for instance, you'll see a lot of L whatever. The D version exists, but usually for organisms, the L version is the one that works. You know, for amino acids that make up proteins, there's a left-handed and right-handed version, but only one of them is made by organisms. Okay, 10. This is an introduction to functional groups. What we're looking at here are two different molecules. They look very similar in structure, but the only difference is the shaded parts. These are estradiol, which is an estrogen, and testosterone. Drastically different in their effects, right? Estrogen is a feminizing hormone. Testosterone is a masculizing hormone. But they both start out, and they're not only very similar, they both start out as exactly the same molecule, which is cholesterol, and then gets just slightly modified to have those drastically different effects. The reason they have such different effects, though, is because of these functional groups shown in blue, which are not, you know, you had an introduction to functional groups in the lab already, but they're called functional groups because that particular small collection of atoms that are just part of the overall molecule give the overall molecule specific functions because they're there, because of how they interact with other things. All right, so I told you already have to know these from the lab. Now it's finally time to go through these functional groups that you have to know. Keep in mind that no functional group is by itself a complete molecule, right? It's stuck on to the rest of the molecule, which is why you can have notations like R dash whatever the functional group is. For hydroxyl, the first one we're looking at here, it could either be R-OH or just -OH. You don't have to write the R. But either case, the OH by itself is only part of the molecule. R stands for residue, which simply means the rest of the molecule, whatever it is. Okay? In the ball and stick model, though, you know it's not a complete molecule if it has a stick hanging off of it, which is not connected to another ball, right? So functional groups are just parts of molecules. And hydroxyl is the first one, an OH. By the way, you could write that, an OH, also as HO dash, but not as OH dash. What's wrong with this one?
I live on the left.
OH dash shows hydrogen forming two bonds. It has a valence of one, right? So the dash always goes with the oxygen. It has to make two bonds, one with the rest and one with hydrogen. Okay, so hydroxyls define alcohols. Any given molecule either has a hydroxyl group in it or it doesn't. If it has a hydroxyl group in it, that makes that molecule and alcohol. There's not one type of alcohol. There's many, many types of alcohol. Things that contain hydroxyls are alcohols, including sugars, by the way. Sugars are alcohols as well. There's a lot of alcohols because there's a lot of hydroxyls. They're biologically important because the OH bond makes it polar, just like it does in water, because of the high the difference in electronegativity of oxygen and hydrogen. Okay? Carbonyl is next, which, as you see, is a carbon double bonded to an oxygen. And so there's two connections, two other bonds that the carbon has to make for a total of four, of course. Well, in this case, there's two ways that can happen. And you can see the two examples illustrating the two ways. One is that the carbonyl group, the carbon that's part of the carbonyl, which is the shaded part here, that carbon can be either at the end of a carbon skeleton, and doesn't matter what end, or on any tip of a branch either. It's either at an end or it's not. In this case, it's not, right? It's in the middle of this group of three. Wouldn't that have to be the middle, though? Just anywhere other than an end is the other possibility. So when we're talking about compounds that contain a carbonyl group, there's two major categories, which are called ketones and aldehydes. Here's a ketone and here's an aldehyde. And I always got these mixed up in my mind until one day I realized something that hopefully will help you. Aldehydes are the ones that have the carbonyl group at a tip of the carbon skeleton. The carbon that's part of the carbonyl is actually at a tip. A ketone, on the other hand, it's not at a tip. And what I realize is that the word aldehyde starts with A, which is at a tip of the alphabet. Whereas ketone, starting with a K, is somewhere in the middle of the alphabet. So you can memorize it that way if it helps you. But they're both carbonyl-containing compounds. We just give them different names based on the position of that carbonyl group. And we see carbonyls in sugars, for instance, monosaccharides that are important as fuels. And we're going to talk much more about those. Carboxyl is next, and this is one that confuses people, which you might have been confused in lab about this, because it looks like this is a hydroxyl group and a carbonyl group. And technically it is, except that we don't consider it to be a hydroxyl group or a carbonyl group. When it's in this particular arrangement, we consider this to just be one overall group called a carboxyl group. And just notice linguistically that the word carboxyl comes from the fact that it's a combination of the words carbonyl and hydroxyl. So it really is both, but we don't consider it to be carbonyl or hydroxyl. Carboxyl instead. And we call things that contain carboxyl groups carboxylic acids, including all of the amino acids that make up all the proteins throughout all of life. So they're very important. Let me just quickly go through these. And you can leave if you need to, but I'm going to actually complete the recording. You don't have to feel you have to stay, though. It's only going to take me another minute or so. Amino group is next. When you see amino or amine or amino, all of those point to nitrogen. There's a nitrogen in there somewhere. You can see that it's a nitrogen and two hydrogens with the nitrogen bound to the rest of the molecule. And so, once again, amino acids are called this because each individual amino acid, which is a building block of a protein, contains an amino group. On the other end of it, though, you have a carboxyl group. So amino acids are both aminos and carboxylic acids, which is why they're called amino acids. Sulfhydryl is next, SH, which looks just like a hydroxyl, right, except it's sulfur instead of oxygen, which shouldn't surprise you after the lab because sulfur is in that same group as oxygen, has the same valence. So they get the... If something contains a sulfhydryl, they're called thiols. Now, alcohols end in OL. The names end in OL to tell you it's an alcohol, like ethanol, for instance. Ethane-like alcohols, what it literally means. The thio part of thiols means sulfur. So thiols literally means sulfur alcohols. They're not really alcohols because they don't have OH, but they act like them in a way because they have similar properties, and therefore they get the word thiols, sulfur alcohol, sulfur alcohol-like substances. Phosphates are next. This is the most complex in terms of structure. It is a phosphorus atom surrounded by four oxygen atoms, one of which is then bound to the skeleton. And phosphates are impossible to overstate how important they are, because they are a member of every individual nucleotide, which is a building block of a nucleic acid. You can't have DNA or RNA without phosphate. You also can't have ATP, which we're going to study in detail, which is the main energy currency of cells, without phosphates, and other reasons as well. And methyls you find all over the place in molecules at the tips of carbon skeletons, because a carbon at the tip needs to, if it's only forming a single bond with the other carbon, it needs to make three more bonds. The easiest way is to fill it in with hydrogens. So you find methyls all over the place. And methyls are important for various reasons, including they help cells to turn off genes so they don't get expressed, at least temporarily. All right, so I breezed through those pretty quickly, but hopefully now they make a little bit more sense to you than they did in lab.